Remember in the book Chronicles of Narnia, the little fawn guy, the imaginary character, is in a dungeon cell of the evil queen, and right next to her, right next to the fawn, is Edmund, one of the four children from England, and the witch comes down there to gloat and asks the fawn and says, "Do you know why you're here?" And he says, "I'm here because I believe in a free Narnia." And she goes, "No, you're here because he turned you in for sweetmeats." And from his point of view, from the fawn's point of view, I guess that was true. He believed in a free Narnia. From the witch's point of view, the queen's point of view, it was because somebody turned him in. When you take somebody like Dan Olson, who I think is out of town today, but he's been worshiping with us for the last year or two, and not only is a pleasure to have in class, but he's here glorifying the name of Jesus Christ. He's here why? He's here because of the truth and because he had an open heart, and that's for sure. But he is also here because Pete Bowling took the time over a period of months or years to get to know Dan and to offer him the gospel. And when the time was right in Dan Olson's life and he had certain things he wanted to deal with, he turned to Pete. And then he obeyed the gospel as a result of that. When you take Robin Hayes, for example, back there, she's here, why? She's glorifying God, she's on her way to heaven, why? Number one, because the word has the seed in it, and also because she has an open heart, and because the Holy Spirit operated on her mind, but also because Angela Cook and Sue Cook and Harold Cook, over a period of years, cared about Robin and liked Robin and lovingly pointed her to Jesus Christ. And when the time was right in Robin's life, when she was ready to receive the gospel, she did. Maybe that'll be the case. We need to shift gears in evangelism and offer the gospel better for eternal life for Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ deserves to have us do that, doesn't he? So we're going to talk about that this morning in John chapter 4 to try and find some inspiration for us to do better in offering the gospel. It's something that every Christian has a responsibility to do, something that Jesus did personally. Maybe in 2013-14 you'll have your own Dan Olson or Scott Sousa or Robin Hayes sitting next to you as a permanent fixture of the family of Christ because you offered them the gospel. And when we're talking about inspiration for doing that, John 4 is a good way to accomplish that kind of motivation. Once in a while we put a painting up, and we enjoy, like Norman Rockwell's Jury Room, and it helps you to reflect on the idea of moral courage. And maybe there's papers on the floor that show you how long they were there, and maybe the woman weighs a lot less than all the men bending in on her, and maybe there's 16 little details in there that can help you reflect in a great work of art on the nature of courage. Well, in John chapter 4, when Jesus converts the Samaritan woman, how many things are there in there that can inspire us to go ahead and take the step and offer the gospel to that person that we've been thinking about offering it to? So let's take a look at John 4 and see if we can't make a resolution to do a better job of talking about Jesus Christ to a lost and dying world that needs him. In John chapter 4, verse 1, "When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples," I always think of Jesus as teaching apostles who then went and taught others. That actually happens in John 4. Jesus doesn't call the Samaritan woman an apostle, but he teaches her, and then what does she go do? She goes and teaches the Samaritan city because Jesus taught her, and she becomes, in effect, an apostle. Jesus himself isn't physically dunking people in water. His disciples are doing that for him. He left Judea and departed into Galilee. Here's Jerusalem down here to the west of the Dead Sea, and he's down here for the Passover, John chapter 3. And he has to leave Judea, and he has to go back up to Galilee where he was brought up. Now, usually, a Jew would cross the Jordan and go up the east side and go over across again back into Galilee. But he goes through Samaria in John chapter 4. And says in John chapter 4, and so he then comes to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar. Now, when it says he must needs pass through Samaria, right away we talk about all the obstacles that Jesus is facing here. When you talk about the fact that they would usually go around the Jordan and then back up into Galilee, that made the journey how much longer? Does anybody know? The historians tell you that if you went straight through Samaria, it would take you 3 days. If you crossed the Jordan and went up around and then over, it would take you 7 days one way. So think about it. You're going to go down to Disneyland for your vacation. It's going to cost you an extra 4 days both ways because you've got to drive around Oregon. So you get 1 week in Disneyland instead of two because you hate those idiotic Oregon people. That's the problem that you're getting at. So they'd walk all the way around some area. I can't go through Oregon, so I've got to go through Perea over here. What kind of a district are we talking about here? Are we talking about they kind of had a little tension going on? Or are we talking about it's a war zone that you've got to pass through? Or what is the deal? Well, like we say, first of all, he's going through here and he's taking 4 days less one way because he's willing to go through there. But, of course, he has a different point of view than most Jews do. Now, we'll get to that in just a second. Now, he comes to Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well. Now, here is a modern picture of this very well. And, of course, they've built up a museum-type thing around it, and it's become a gigantic tourist attraction. They celebrate the Eucharist there, and you can only get pictures of it every so often. But what it used to look like was probably something a lot more like this right here, and there was masonry round about it for about 6 or 8 feet deep, probably 7 or 8 feet wide or something like that. And they say it was 135 feet deep. Now, think about that for a second. We're talking Genesis 26, Jacob dug this well. You're talking nearly the dawn of human civilization. It's normal ground for about 8 or 10 feet, and then starting at 10 feet, it is solid rock, limestone, down to 135 feet to where they actually get some water going through there. So let's take us with, I don't even know if they were to the Bronze Age yet when Jacob dug this well. How exactly are you going to dig a pit 8 feet deep, 135 feet down into the ground? But they did it. And when this woman talks to Jesus Christ, and Jesus says, I've got better water than this, and she says in John chapter 4, verse 12, I think it is, says, are you greater than our father Jacob? The providing of water was a metaphor for providing a home to your people, right? If you could get water out of this kind of place, she goes, are you wiser than Jacob? Are you better than Jacob? Where here in this area are you going to get better water than there is in this well? But that's kind of the subject of the day, is this water that he's talking about. You've got this tourist attraction, Jacob's Well, that's kind of like the Grand Canyon or something in that area. She comes over the hill to get some water, and she doesn't know that the fountain of water, you could say the God of water, is sitting on her well that day, and he's going to offer her something a little better. So, in John chapter 4, he continues with the problems that Jesus has. This isn't an easy conversion that he's coming into. In John chapter 3, there's exactly the opposite conversion. Who did Jesus convert in John 3? He converted Nicodemus, highly educated, highly literate, probably wealthy member of the Sanhedrin. Jesus converted him, or taught him the gospel at a very minimum, probably obeyed the gospel later. And here, the very opposite. Here's a woman who's not even a Jew, has moral issues, has a different understanding. Jesus teaches her the gospel. So John chapter 4, verse 7, there comes a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus says, give me to drink. This in the original language, they say. It's actually a polite way of putting it. For the disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Now, why do you suppose Jesus was more tired than his disciples? Do you suppose Jesus had been doing anything down in Judea that his disciples had not been doing? He's very weary from all of his work down there, as well as this journey. And then says the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that you, being a Jew, asks drink of me, who am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Now, when it says no dealings with the Samaritans, that comes from a word korao, which means they don't borrow anything from us. They don't want to have any material obligation whatsoever. They don't want to sit with you. They don't want to talk with you. They don't want... Cindy and I have sent out a few eBay things and, done some business on eBay. And when Cindy packs something up and mails it to somebody, she throws a Lifesaver mint in there. And she throws a little handwritten note sometimes and let us know how you like it. And it's sometimes it's wrapped in cellophane and she sends it out. And if somebody doesn't like it, they can get angry. And they send it back and it's got the tissue paper and it's got her handwritten note. And it's got the mints in there as keep your stupid mints. I don't want to be obligated to you for the mint in case there should be some dispute about this transaction. Some people don't mean it that way, but some people kind of do mean it that way. The idea with the Jew is, I ain't going to borrow $5 from you. I'm not going to sell you something for $2 unless there should be some kind of a dispute and I should have to deal with you later. When it says they've got no dealings with Samaritans, this is a major problem. Now you know, by the way, I'm back up here for a few things. When Israel fell and God judged them, he judged Judea and took them into captivity about 120 years later than he did the northern section of Israel. And when Israel went off into Assyrian captivity, it was almost uninhabited. There's just a few people there, but mountain lions were overrunning the place. And so the king, this is 2 Kings chapter 17, if you want to read about it, the king sends settlers back in there, and they interbreed with the Jews. And so you've got sort of a mixed race situation going on. And they are teaching them the customs of the God of land, so lions won't be tearing people apart. And that's, they believe in the first five books of the law, Moses, and so they're teaching sort of a corrupt religion. Later on, Judea also goes into Babylonian captivity, and when they come back, Ezra and Nehemiah are trying to build the wall and build the temple, but there are a bunch of bad guys who say, hey, we want a part in this temple. You're going to be doing some cool business. And they say, get out of town. We don't want any dirty Samaritans in here. And how do they react to that? They try and hinder the whole thing, and there's warfare from then on. Part of the reason the Samaritans hate the Jews so much is they perceive the Samaritans, they perceive the Jews as thinking they are gum on their shoe. I want to put this right, you know, because it's kind of politically correct. I've had some dealings with the militant homosexual group, and I've had some dealings with abortionists. And many of them don't like Christians at all. And the reason is they think that Christians think they are the scum of the earth. And they resent it. And that's the source of the problem. And the Samaritans thought that the Jews thought that they were the scum of the earth, and there had been the warfare problems in the past. And was it a problem? Lee just read for us in Luke chapter 7 or 9, I forget, Luke chapter 9, I think, where the apostles went through there, and they were on their way to the Passover, and especially if you're a Jew going from Galilee down to Judea for the Passover, it's like, oh, you're on your way to a KKK rally, are you? Well, we got something for you. Take this with you. And they wouldn't receive Jesus, and the apostles were in Samaria when they said, Lord, how about we just call down fire like Elijah didn't destroy this place? And Jesus said, you don't get what manner of spirit that you're of. So the point that we're getting at is there's a serious obstacle to his preaching the gospel, and when it says in John chapter 4, verse 7, then comes a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus says, give me to drink. Probably you young people don't realize that when the AIDS scare first took place, people were scared that you could catch it off somebody's cup or water or public toilet seat or whatever. And for a Jew to not just sell something to a Samaritan, but also for a Jew to drink out of that Samaritan's cup, to a Jew, I mean, you would have the same reaction if we took a cup and we had been using it for sewage. And then I rinsed it under a little water and said, here's your cup of water. That's the way the Jew would look at something like that. But does Jesus look at it like that? I was talking with Roger Eccles yesterday, and I asked him, what do you think of when you first think of John chapter 4 and the woman at the well? And he said, I think of John chapter 8 and the woman taken in adultery. And I think of how different, what a contrast there is between the way that men look at things and the way that God looks at things. She's got another issue. She's not only a Samaritan, she's also what? She's also a woman. Now, Cindy and I drove a white Honda Civic, 1996 is that model. We drove that for I don't know how many years, because Cindy and I always go back and forth. We get tired of the car payment on a new car, and then we sell our new car, and then we buy an old beater car for $2,000 and enjoy our nice clean budget with that car payment taken right out of it, and we drive the old car for a while. But then what happens with the old car? starts pretty soon. I've got a line item in my budget: replace transmission, and that's $1,100 or something like that. And after a while, I get tired of working on the old car, and so, you know, what would be nice would be to have no car repair bills. Bam, we're down there buying a 2012 Accord. We go back and forth. When I didn't want the Honda Civic, or I didn't want the Lexus, that, you know, the 1999 Lexus, I put it in the paper and I sold it. Why would I bring up that illustration as it pertains to Jewish marriage? Because the Jews looked at divorcing your wife exactly the way you would look at selling a used car once you got tired of it. That was the way. The Romans might have their wife killed when they got tired of it. Literally, look it up. You were bothering me, baby. I'll show you. You didn't even have to get particularly approval from the government if you were rich and powerful and so forth. So if you didn't like your wife, just have her offed. Or if you're a Jew, just throw her on the street and let her beg for bread. That's the way they looked at women back then. America 2013 is not the way. Galatians chapter 3, verse 27, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither male nor female, there's neither bond nor free. You are all one in Christ Jesus. By a strange coincidence, Jesus looks at things the way God does. And Jesus' way of looking at things stands the test of time. So man has all these prejudices, all this tension, all this hatred. Jesus goes right through Samaria and he says, well, this is my daughter too. And so he loves her and he's going to help her. Oh, John chapter 4, verse 10. Take a look at a couple of other things that might inspire us out of the Gospel of John in chapter 4. He says in John chapter 4, in verse 10, John writes, she says, I can't believe that you're asking to drink out of my cup. And the apostles later come in there and they're going to walk in there and they're going to marvel that he's even talking to her. And she's marveling too. Now in verse 10, Jesus says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, give me to drink, you would have asked of him and he would have given you living water. Now, as you're trying to learn how to talk to individuals about the gospel, you know, I analyzed this and thought about this all week and said, what can I extract from this that would be a good way to talk to people in the world? You know, the fact is, you're never going to convert people because you are as well-spoken as our Lord Jesus Christ. You're never going to turn a phrase like him. But what you can do is you can put things in their terms. You can be a listener. A lot of times what people try to do when they're teaching the gospel is say, you should be interested in church. Here's what you should be interested in. Well, what somebody should be interested in is irrelevant. She's interested in water. And so that's what Jesus Christ talks about. In Acts chapter 17, they were interested in unknown gods. And so that's what Paul talked to them about. Jerry Rogers, we had the service yesterday. Everybody who met him said he literally was capable of standing there in the very same spot as you and pulling in twice the fish. And he told me the key was his lures. And did you ever see Jerry's fishing lures? He sold them in 7-Elevens and did a pretty good business with them for a while. And have you ever seen a fishing lure that Jerry Rogers used? It looked stupid. A lot of times it was a little red ball with a little yellow mark on it or something like that, and he'd haul in salmon with these things, and I'd go, that makes no sense. Well, yeah, what makes sense to a salmon brain should be different from what makes sense to you and my, or at least to your brain. What a fit. Personally, I'm very fond of frozen yogurt with raspberries on it. But I can't toss Menchie's into the river and pull a salmon back out. They're interested in something different. And the folks that you're talking to in the gospel aren't yet interested in exactly the same things that you are. So the subject's water. And Jesus slowly brings up this idea in a way that she can relate to. Now you notice another thing that he doesn't do is he does not ask her a question here. He doesn't ask her and say, would you like a Bible class? He doesn't say, have you ever been baptized in water for mission? It's too sudden. You might offer me and say, would you like to buy my car for 50% of its value? Whoa, probably not. What's wrong with it? Don't ask me. Don't lead with a question. You're not going to get a commitment out of me, no matter how good the deal. It's just too sudden. So here's the good news, is as you're preparing to offer the gospel over the next month or two, you don't have to ask somebody for a commitment when you bring it up. You can just introduce the subject rather mildly. There's a There's a waiter that is friends with Cindy and I up there in Bonnie Lake, and he's always stopping by the table to chat with us, and, you know, he's a friendly type of guy and so forth. And he went out of town to Mexico, and he brings us up, and he says, "My dad's down in Mexico, and I'm going down to Mexico," and we'd known each other for a while, so I went down to deep Mexico once, I told him. We're on a Bible mission, actually, and the people down there, and I just changed this, just threw it in there, and the people down there are so giving, they don't have 2 cents to rub together, but they're giving you whatever rice they've got. And he goes, "Oh, you do missionary work? That is so neat. More people should do that." Now, the thing is, here's the thing, as you're preparing to preach the gospel the way Jesus taught it, when you mention the Bible or God just quickly, people's reactions will take one of two directions, won't they? Some people will turn right off. Fine. You know, you didn't ask them to sign on the dotted line anyway. You just mentioned it. No harm done. I haven't hurt your life. And you go on. Or maybe somebody brightens up and they say, "Oh, you go to church there?" And they're interested. And then guess what? Then you're in John chapter 4. So next time that we go there, Scott and Joel have been working really hard on our Andrew's and my shiny new evangelism tool. We've got these new welcome packets that we give out, and we're going to make sure the visitors get these, and they're designed as evangelism tools, too. They have a double-sided CD in them, and Joel has done a great job of, let's see if I can even, I packed this one so it's no good, you know, but the disc is kind of neat, and the point is they don't have to commit to you to go home and stick this in their car, so anybody who is interested, just drop this off with them next time I'm in there. I'll probably mention to the guy, "Hey, we were talking about missions in Mexico, can I just leave this with you?" He'll take it home, it can't be a sudden thing, you know what I'm talking about? Cindy, when she was getting the LaGrange thing ready up there in, up there in Kent, as she's talking to the woman, and the woman is a square dancer, and she mentioned, "We've got to have it here because we don't personally think it's authorized to have it in the building," and then she changed the subject, and next time she was in there, the woman asked about that, and she takes the square, you know, square dancing, it's so nice that people aren't into lascivious dancing. She's been teaching it for 50 years or something, and she talks about the square dancing a little bit, and next thing, Cindy gives her a business card, and if somebody's interested, they'll let you know that they're interested. So Jesus builds her interest, right? And he says, he would have given you living water if you would have asked him of it. Now, when you say living water, we say, "Oh, tee-hee, magic water." That's not really what he means. Now, I see Dr. Oz on TV selling acai berry and selling crystal water, and somebody tells you, "No, I've got a sparkling water that adds vitality to you," and he's being serious about it. He would have given you living water. You can drink this water and not get thirsty anymore. And the woman doesn't get that. She says, "You don't have anything to draw with, and the well is deep, I'll say, 100 plus feet. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank thereof, and his children and his cattle?" So now she's getting kind of interested in John chapter 4, verse 13, and Jesus answers, and he develops it. Now, here's a benefit to her, this water. She's a person, let's just suppose that before Bev got to eat lunch this afternoon, she had to leave here, and she had to walk over to Fred Meyer, and she had to take, you know, a 2-gallon jug, and she had to lower it 100 feet into a well, pull it up hand by hand, fill it this jug with it, do it 3 or 4 more times, then walk back here before she could eat. Would that be a little chore or a big chore, this drawing water? So she's very interested in that, and he's going to lock it up here. But the point that we most wanted to get at is Jesus has a different attitude towards a Samaritan woman than even the apostles did, right? And when people can tell, put it this way. Is it okay for you to like a person who's not a Christian, or is that kind of disloyal to Christ? It's kind of like that old joke where somebody comes up to a priest and says, I've smoked for a long time. Is it okay if I smoke when I pray? The priest says, "Are you kidding? God wouldn't want you to smoke when you pray." And then the guy thought of another angle and asked a different priest, and he says, "You know what? I've got a smoke break at work, and I'm hooked on smoking. Do you think it'd be okay if I prayed on my smoke break?" So, yeah, you can pray while you smoke. That's the way you look at it. Somebody has a friend from high school, and they say, "Can I convert my friend from high school?" Can you convert your best friend like Angela converted her best friend Rob? Can you convert your best? Well, sure. Okay, if I'm going to convert somebody, can I be friends with them though? No, you shouldn't be friends with somebody who's not a Christian. That's kind of disloyal to the moral code. No, Jesus Christ, Romans chapter 5 tells us, while we were yet sinners, that means while we were total rebels, Christ felt so strongly about us that he gave himself on the cross. It's the way Dwight C. Thompson, his dad was a Pentecostal preacher, and Dwight C. Thompson, who later became a famous TV evangelist, went off the reservation and he went on a road trip and he's drinking and he's smoking and his dad's a super strict-laced Pentecostal, and his dad went after him, and his dad went into the hotel room where he was when he found him. Dwight Thompson told this in a sermon one time, and he thought his dad was going to start screaming, and his dad said, "Son, I've missed you." And he looked over on the thing, and there's the Lucky Strikes on the, you know, the cigarettes on the counter. And he says, "Lucky Strikes, and my brand was Marlboro before I became a Christian." He gave his son a hug, and they sat down and just chat. He wasn't saying smoking and drinking is okay, but the son wanted to know that he was still the dad's little boy, even if he didn't go to church. He needed to know that at some point in his life. And our friends need to know that we don't think that they're the gum on our shoe just because they haven't yet been restored to God's grace. That they're going to be one of these days when we teach them the God. That attitude, it's like in golf. You know, we're trying to pull out a way to describe this now. Somebody wants to hold their hands in a particular way. Sometimes it's an attitude. John's an excellent athlete, and the only sport he can't play is golf because he's too greedy. And he winds that club up. It's not a technique. It's an attitude. You know, an old dad, the schlub, you know, I just pull the club back to here, and I make contact. It's an attitude. You say, how do I preach a gospel? It's an attitude that the person you're talking to is cool. Did the Samaritan woman get that from Jesus Christ? So Jesus is offering her the gospel, and the woman says, "Sir, I'll take some. Give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come here to draw." All right, time for a Bible study. Jesus says, "Go and call your husband and come here." If this guy up at the restaurant says, "Oh, great, where do you guys worship?" We'll say, "How about next Friday? You know, let's get together and talk a little Bible," and the person's interest has been built a little bit. Hopefully, that's the way he'll respond. So, when he says, "Go call your husband and come here," the woman answers and says, "I have no husband." And he says, "You have well said, I have no husbands. You've had five husbands, and he whom you now have is not your husband, and that you said truly." good job telling the truth on that. When he calls that man that she's shacked up with her husband, God is being awfully polite about this situation. How critical exactly is he being? She's on her sixth guy, and Jesus is on a scale of 0 to 100. How critical is Jesus being of her morals? Zero. Suppose Jennifer goes and becomes a drug dealer. She'll still be my daughter. She'll have bought herself a bunch of pain. I'll have a lot of work to do to get her fixed up again, but she's still my daughter. That at least is the attitude I'm hoping for from her. You know, that if I went crazy and went off to Australia or something, she doesn't love me just because I do a sermon on Sunday morning. That's not the only reason. And does God only love us because we've got our heads on straight? So again and again, you see God holding out his hand all the livelong day until finally we get the ability to, like it says in Luke 15, to come to ourselves and realize where we are. And so the gentleness and grace with which Jesus handles her sinful life, just amazing. There's a man named Ted Forbes, a true story. In 1984, he's walking down the street and he sees a wallet. And he picks up the wallet, and this guy was loaded because he opens that wallet. There is no identification of any kind. There's just $3. And he looks through it, looking for some way to return the wallet to its owner. And the only other thing in there is a little folded piece of paper dated 1924. Now, this was 1984. He had a letter in there from 60 years before that. And he opens it up, and it's a letter to a Michael from a Hannah, and it's a "Dear John, you know, I wish we had gotten married, but my parents have forbidden us to see one another again." This guy had carried this for 60 years. And so he's going to try and find out where in the world, and I forget even how he tracked it down. There was a return address, I guess, on a little envelope or something. He goes to that house, and that person says, no, she's living down at this apartment. There's one huge apartment for the elderly in the city, you know, 8 stories high or something. He goes down there, and the person does know a Hannah. He goes up there. He rings the doorbell. There is a Hannah Mitchell, I think was her name, and she's 73 years old, and she's bright-eyed and alert and so forth, and he says, ma'am, I'm trying to return this wallet. Would you know anything about this letter? And she opens it up, and it's a letter she wrote 60 years before to a Michael, and she starts crying, and she says, if you ever find this guy, would you please tell him I never married, and I thought about him every day? He says, I'll try. And so he wraps it back up, and he's carrying the wallet. Amazing synchronicity. And he's carrying the wallet, and he's leaving the building, and a janitor sees him, and he goes, that's Mr. Goldstein's wallet. He's always losing it. Like I say, there's just one apartment for the elderly in this whole little town. And he says, he lives on the 8th floor. I'll take you up to him. And they knock on his door, and Michael Goldstein, do you reckon? Oh, my wallet. And he goes, well, what about the letter in it? I read it so I could get it back to you. You know, the Ted Forbes tells him, do you ever think about her? And he says he'd never married. He says, I've got a surprise for you. And he takes a guy by the hand, and he takes him from the 8th floor down to the 3rd floor, and they ring the doorbell. Hadn't seen one another in 60 years. And when they open the door, they fall into one another's arms. 3 weeks later, Ted Forbes gets a call. Would you be our best man? 78-year-old, 73-year-old, acting like teenagers. This is Luke 15, where Christ tries to explain, if a woman has 10 coins and loses one, if you have 100 sheep and you lose one, what do? You want them back. It's not a Samaritans versus Jews hot war situation. We're all created in God's image, like this woman was created in God's image, like we needed to be restored to God's image, and that attitude. So Jesus very graciously says, yep, you've had a hard life. You remember when Jesus told Paul the apostle, murdering his children, says, Paul, you've bit yourself off a rough row to hoe here, haven't you? This can't be very fun for you. Jesus told Paul, killing his children, this can't be a very good life. How about I show you a better life? The degree of his graciousness is just absolutely beyond belief. So John chapter 4, verse 19, the woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Andrew, do you have a couple of boxes with these things, with these packets, whatever? We're going to go ahead and hand these packets out. They've got a note in them that describes the plan of salvation. They've got a note that introduces people, what they'll find at our services. They've got CDs in them they can listen to and various little things. So the men, I think, do we have enough to hand out there? If you want one. They cost, by the way, I think they cost about $2 a piece, so you don't just throw them on restaurant tables, probably. But if you've got a name in mind and you're hoping for a Bible class with Joe Shlobotnik and you're praying, then give Joe Shlobotnik one of these welcome things if that's your best way to get a class with them. We hope that Scott and Jenny back there give out 20 of them over the next month, and maybe one person will come in here and obey the gospel, and that's what we're here for. So, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Now, just very quickly here, verse 20, it starts to the plot thickens. She has a question. It says, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus has an answer for that. Now here is, she's got a huge question on her mind. Dan Olson, when he came in, he had a huge question on his mind. Robin Hayes, when she came in, had a few questions on her mind. How do you handle this? How do you handle the next? How do you handle the other thing? Her question is, look, I don't get this. She's got an unsolvable question for any Jew. She says, now Jacob, the patriarch Jacob, worshipped on Mount Gerizim and was pleasing to God. I always hear from the Jews, you've got to go to Mount Zion, and unless you put your foot down in that particular little spot, you can't worship God. That can't be right, because Jacob, I mean, it'd be like, suppose we got wrapped around the axle about gun rights, and Sam rolled out the argument and said, look, George Washington believed you could carry guns. Doesn't that solve the whole thing? And this woman's got an unanswerable argument. She says, wasn't Jacob okay to worship in Mount? So see, the Samaritans actually thought they were right and the Jews were wrong. And how does Jesus answer that? He does not get confrontational. He does not invalidate her question. Right away he says, you know, that is a great point, you know, so to speak. He says, woman, believe me, the hour's coming when it's not going to matter what mountain. Brother Olson, he's not here, so I can pick on him. He was very interested in politics when he first got started. Now, is there anything good about being a patriot? He believes in all these values that sync up with the Bible, so can you afford to find that which is good, which is what he's... You know, so few people nowadays believe in loyalty and honor and the Constitution. Those are good things. Whatever your prospect is interested in, there's something good in what they're interested in, right? And there's something good in what this woman's interested in, which is that it's not where you personally are standing. Worship is from the inside out. Now, by the way, you worship, you know not what. We know what we worship for salvation is the Jews. He now gives her some bread of life also, right? Okay, so you worship sincerely, but you don't have any idea of what. 1 John chapter 2 tells us, I write unto you, fathers, because you have known him who is of the beginning. All right, so in other words, let's just say that Matt has been married to a woman he's never met. That's not the case. We'd have to take somebody single. Let's take my son John for a second. Let's suppose John is married to somebody he's never met, and she lives in Europe, and he's going to write letters with her for 12 years. And as a matter of fact, she never agreed to marry him, but her friends agreed to marry. And so he's guessing about what she's like. What, is there any problem with that? Whereas Matt knows his wife. Jesus is saying, you're taking blind guesses at who God is, what he wants. The whole point of spirituality is to know God and to connect with him. Let me ask you this. Where in the Old Testament or New Testament did somebody come up and say, God, I want to please you? When? You find me the page, please, where God said, yeah, go dream up something you can do for me. Did God ever say that? Isaiah says, here am I, send me. And God says, thanks for volunteering. I need this, this, and this done. Andrew says, I'm willing to be a Christian, and God says, thanks, I need this, this, and this. God never, at any point in the Bible, anywhere, said, hey, you go think of something that you want to do for me. God's already got better things to do than we can think of. So you want to do something for God? How about being a light to the world and evangelizing? Has he specified that as something that would please him? So, yes, you're absolutely right. Worship is from the inside out, but you worship you know not what, for we know what we worship. Salvation is of the Jews, but the hour comes, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeks such to worship him. And so now he's going to redirect the ideas to joy and love and faith. Once somebody's in, look, once you start a Bible class and they say, look, I'm really interested in the right to keep and bear arms. And you say, you know what's great about that is personal responsibility and a man willing to defend his family. Yeah, isn't that great? And then he's got a question and you give him something interesting on that. Now they're pretty much nodding with you. You know, you can talk about joy and love and faith in John chapter 4 and verse 24. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Andrew, did we decide we don't have any of those things back there, or what happened? I didn't say to hand them out. Simon says hand them out. did you guys assume that I wanted them to hand that out? I don't know. I don't get it. All right, so anyway, John chapter 4, in verses 25 and 26. The woman says, I know that Messiah is coming, who's called Christ. When he has come, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to her, I who speak unto thee am he. Now, Pete told me not to think about the Seahawks today, so I'm not going to think about the Seahawks. But there's one athlete, Richard Sherman. Have you ever heard of this guy? He's a star for some local team that plays in the fall. And he was on TV this last spring. He was playing pranks on people as an interviewer because he thinks he's the best player in the NFL versus this Darrell Revis guy. And he'd come up to somebody and he'd say, who do you think's better, Richard Sherman or Darrell Revis? And this is in New York he's doing this. So everybody, he'd be talking to people, Richard Sherman wouldn't. He'd, what do you who do you think's better, Richard Sherman or Darrell Revis? Richard Sherman asking this, and the guy didn't know who he was. The guy'd say, Richard Sherman, that guy's an idiot. Really? What exactly don't you like about him? And one guy said, well, for one thing, he's fat. And Sherman would go, he's fat? And Richard Sherman's like 2% body fat or something. He'd egg the guy on saying the worst thing, and all of a sudden he'd go, hi, Richard Sherman. And the person would just totally frazz out. What do you say then? You know, hi, Jeff Clark, the guy you've been running. You don't know what to say. So Jesus never introduced himself to the Jews. He'd always say, it's under the couch, it's behind the chair, you're getting warmer. He made them work for it because they had a greater responsibility. But to the Samaritan woman, he just says, I who speak unto you am he. Okay, so once we realize that Jesus is who he is, what do? Well, John chapter 4 and verse 27, upon this, his disciples walk into the scene like a stage play and marveled that he talked. But nobody was going to ask him. Nobody's going to challenge him. Woman left her water pot there, went into the city, come see a man who told me all the things that I ever did. One of the most heartwarming things is you start talking to somebody about the gospel, and before they decide and obey the gospel, have you ever seen they start wanting to bring their friends to the Bible class? I've got to show my uncle. Well, how about you be converted first? Well, that's the way the woman goes, though. And I don't know. John chapter 4. I always think of Jesus as teaching his apostles who taught others, but some people had the privilege of being taught the gospel by Jesus Christ himself. That would have really been something, wouldn't it? So, the Samaritans wound up obeying the gospel later in the book of Acts. So Jesus says, my need is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Okay, so that's John chapter 4, and we've got a job to do. If you really want to respond to the gospel, might not be in repentance, but one of the great ways to respond to the gospel might be, before you leave, to say, the person that I'm going to give one of these new shiny little new toys with, to, or I'm going to give a business card to. Andrew says if it's just a tip on a restaurant table, leave the business card, not the package. The individual that I'm going to preach gospel to before 2013 comes to a close is this person. This waiter in this restaurant, or this neighbor I have, or this sister, I'm going to mention the gospel. That would be pleasing to God. Jesus deserves it. If we can help you in any way, come forward as we stand and sing, number 103.